It's funny, David, when you read, there are these subtle moments where I feel, oh, that transmission that we spoke about earlier from Mage to you and you embodying that. Like I feel these certain moments, it's a syllable or an utterance or like a spirit, because it was also in me. I'm like, oh, I recognize that, you know? I recognize that as familiar and same.
That's beautiful. Yeah. So many moments that I carry with me that nourish me, you know, that Mage, you know, used to drive around town in his old Nova, and he'd just pull into people's driveways and honk, right? Which meant come on out and talk with me for a bit, for a spell. Mage used to say that in the presence of poetry, he could breathe more easily. You know, as his health deteriorated, his lungs damaged from his polio, constricting, and his, you know, his he had difficulty getting oxygen. He told me one summer, he said that he was memorizing poems and reciting them because he loved to feel the poem in his body. And I think he drew sustenance from that. So he loved this poem by Antonio Machado, right? Last night as I was sleeping.
Might we hear
And
it? Might we hear?
he recited it to me one summer day as I leaned into his car. And he needed, it's like he had a gift and he needed to find someone to give it to. And in the giving, you know, as Robert Bly says, a poem is not completed until it's heard. Mage was always trying to complete something so much bigger than a damn poem on a page. It was how it made our lives living poems. It was how it made us whole.
He was
Poetry was a vehicle.
called to something that I think only he and only in where he is now might understand. I don't He was called to something different and large, and polio, for in my understanding, was a part of that, to craft or extract something deep within him that would never have otherwise been expressed or known by himself and everyone. And actually, we could talk about it. I'm compiling Poems of a Gold Carp, the collected works of Major Reagan. And in it, I talk about what I understand, and I'm doing the biography, and what I understand the biography of Mage, the linchpin of what I'm conveying is that Mage's one teaching, if you had to summarize it, was, in my understanding, is he taught endurance or inexhaustibility, like
Right.
just that regenerative quality that kept him double his lifespan, that by the doctors, that how could that be? It was his heart, that regenerative service oriented, must be, I must give this because I've been called to give this. So regardless of what the doctors tell me or what they
Right.
say, I will complete what I've been ascribed to do. And I think that in that way, maybe only he now begins to understand the totality of really the scope of what he was called to.
I love that. So, this is just from a little scene in the memoir that I've recently finished called The Prayer Wheel. And Mage, my relationship with Mage and with this tent with Kent, Ohio, and with the open readings is a thread that plays is very very important within the stories I tell. In recent years, I write, in recent years, Mage's health has been declining, and his lungs, which were damaged from polio when he was a child, draw less and less oxygen. Yet, in the presence of poetry, Mage says, he can breathe more easily. He has given up his crutches, which he called his sticks, and now uses a wheelchair that he carries in a plastic shell on top of his Nova car. This afternoon, I hear a short honk in my driveway and recognize this as Mage's way of announcing he's here to visit without having to get out of his car. I come outside and lean into his open window, and he tells me that he has been memorizing poems and that he loves to feel how they open space inside his body, help him breathe, and give him oxygen. He says he's been driving around town looking for a friend, someone he can recite this poem to, and asks if I'd like to hear it, a poem by Antonio Machado that he has learned by heart. Last night, as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous air, that a spring was breaking out in my heart. I said, along which secret aqueduct, O water, are you coming to me? Water of a new life that I have never drunk. Last night, as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous air, that I had a beehive here inside my heart. And the golden bees were making white combs and sweet honey from my old failures. Last night, as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous air, that a fiery sun was giving light inside my heart. It was fiery because I felt warmth as from a hearth, and sun because it gave light and brought tears to my eyes. Last night, as I slept, I dreamt, marvelous air, that it was God I had here inside my heart. Standing in the driveway, listening to Mage, I feel him pour his heart into mine. I understand Machado's poem now in a way I could not have understood it in my early 20s. I know now my heart is not empty, but filled with so much. With spring, water, the sun, a beehive, God, with my mother's love and Mage's love, indeed, with the love of a whole town.
Yeah, I remember I would come down to visit from Buffalo to Kent and visit with Mage. And there is always this sense that I had that what is happening with poetry and the poetry community in Kent, it's unique. It's very specifically like individual, like no other time and place is quite like it. And it is a kind of torchbearer or a holder of teachings that are necessary for the world in this time and place. I mean, I feel that way very, I don't know that I had language for it at that time, but that's kind of, as I mature and look, Kent is a necessary wisdom holder, a wisdom keeper, the poetry community there in Kent. You know, and I spring off into Buffalo and who knows, other people go other which places, but that's born, the seeds were planted, I think, by that kind of special energy, that vortex of spiritual energy that is Kent, Ohio. And I think it's what drew Mage there and Maggie and others.
R.C. Wilson now is
R.C.,
leading, you know, organizing and taking on the role of, you know, gathering the monthly readings, the open readings like Mage did, and keeping that alive, that community. But the WIC Poetry Center, I mean, you know, this, I used to joke that when I became the director in 2009, after Maggie retired after 5 years, I mean, Maggie worked for many years as the poet at Kent State University and grew this poetry center from the early 90s to what it became when I took over in 2009. She hired me full-time in 2004 to be the outreach and program director. And we became a center then. It was the WIC Poetry Program for many years before then. But she loved the outreach I did initially for the Ohio Arts Council as a poet of the schools and brought me in to develop an outreach program at the WIC Poetry Center in our own community, Northeast Ohio. And that was close to Maggie's heart. She actually had been a poet in the schools before she got for her first teaching job in academia. And Mage, you know, embodied that commitment to nurturing a community of poets and the community, and bringing people into poetry who were veterans or caregivers or seniors, that, you know, people that had not ever taken it, tried to write a poem. So when I became the director in 2009, I think I invested more of my passion for that work in the community into the WIC, kind of more formally into the WIC Poetry Center. You know, Maggie retired, and then a couple of years later moved to outside of Asheville, North Carolina. You know, Mage was still teaching at Kent State. So I often said to Mage, I said, you know, I'm your front man. You're kind of, you're directing the center. You know, I'm carrying it on, inspired by you and you know, all that you've been doing in this community, kind of bringing the town into the gown. You know, I mean, strengthening those connections between our campus and a university program in our community.
I'm actually recording this. I came on a whim to Rochester, New York, and I'm recording this conversation at the Rochester Zen Center Library.
Oh.
And I know Mage and I had our own kind of like spirit of student-teacher relationship, which no different, yours and Mage, same thing, student-teacher relationship. And you would often talk very deeply with deep kind of reverence and almost like a familiarity with Roshi Philip Kaplu, who in 1966, after 13 years of training in Japan, founded the Rochester Zen Center. He was brought here by a group of people and felt this was the place. And there are two buildings here connected by a corridor that they built. Why do I bring this up is because I felt a deep affinity, obviously with Mage, but also I never met Roshi Philip Kaplu, but you were talking about dreams. And I wanted to share this as a kind of way. One of the things that Mage had done for me is he said, don't ever have it one way. Like if you're going to share, it's got to be a two-way street. And remembering the spirit of what Mage had taught. But I was thinking about this in relation to Mage and Roshi Kaplu. And I had had a dream. I wanted to share sort of a dream that I had that was a capping moment that really closed off something for me, which was, you know, I had a lot of suffering in adolescence and early childhood, which formed a question in me, what is the matter with me?
Hmm.
And so I grappled with this very, very intensely for a while. I had gone to Israel, really grappling with it, reading world's mysticisms, doing introspection, right, prayer, contemplation. Someone sent me the snow leopard. We could talk about the snow leopard as its own separate discussion, Mage's relationship with the snow leopard and how he had students read that in his class. Somebody sent me that. It blew the doors and windows out of my mind in a way that it prepared me when I returned from Israel. I was taking classes at the University of Buffalo. I was on campus getting picked up by my father in a biology class in August 1994, and something broke in me. Like something shattered in me and a light shone. And it was sort of this, I say this, that my poetic life was born at that moment. Oh. But this grappling all came out of what is the matter with me? And after decades of grappling with that, I was living across the street from the Rochester Zen Center in an apartment building that has 10 units directly across from the Zen Center. And in a dream, Roshi Philip Kaplu comes to me in a dream. He says just two words. Is kind of the capping phrase to this question, what is the matter with me? The words in the dream that will stay with me forever are, everything matters.
Wow. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it was, it jolted me as if he were embodied in the, I mean, it was just such a.
Wow.
Yeah, everything matters. And I carry that with me as a kind of like remembrance that when I think about the choice that I have to do kindness or selfishness, boy, everything matters. Like that Mage heart of generosity and magnanimity and like giving, just do that. Everything matters. Just give.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
In the same way that Mage came to you, I felt like Roshi Field Capital had come to me in that way.
Yeah, our dream lives can cut through the dream of our daily lives. They almost wake us up more profoundly than our waking, than our waking lives. I do love, I do believe in the voices. I feel that the what I've been working on has been, hearing the voices of the living and the dead. And, do you get into that state sometimes where you feel very receptive
I do,
and people now come to you and a cashier at the grocery store will say something to you that it just hits, strikes deep into completing a conversation you're having with yourself or a question that you've thrown out to the universe and the universe answers back.
fully. It's so funny because, I struggled for a time with mental health stuff, so I was in and out of like distressed states. And Mage, I did a podcast with Mage. I have two podcasts with Mage. One of the podcasts, Mage was talking about Daniel Thompson. And how Daniel had come to him in a state where he was not in the physical body. And Mage, knowing that I've been in these distressed states, says, I heard Daniel's voice and it said, stop defending what you think you are defending. And he went into this whole thing, but before he said that, he said, I heard Daniel's voice and he's not in the body. And he said, that's right. He said, I hear voices. And then he said, I hope you do too. Just this very sweet kind of like affirmation that like it's just very much a part of our human experience that Rilke says this that like visions, death, spirit world, all those things that are so closely akin to us, our senses have been atrophied because of lack of use, that they're in decay. We don't use because we don't use them and acknowledge them, they've kind of withered, but they're very much the lifeblood of our existence, the other side of the coin,
Yeah, just like the sense that the Mayans saying that the other world sings us into being, that we are the song of whether we realize it or not, of our ancestors singing. I'm convinced the healthy, having that relation that Mage said to me once, we were sitting in Standing Rock Cemetery. We often went there together. And he says, he thinks he said, as we get older, we have more conversations, with the dead. And he says, that's how it should be. Our relationship with the dead becomes more a part of our daily lives. But I love this notion from Francis Weller, who's, he says, how we tend to the dead is as important as how we tend to the living. And so, how do I transform, bringing Mage and my brother, my mother and Mage, are still living in me, and guiding me and feeding me with their love. And how do I use what they feed me, the love that that I feel that they're feeding me and the guidance to tend to the real, to everything matters, to the child in front of me, to the hurt, to issues in our politics and our world and our environment. How can I love the world, the broken world we live in? My love and care, how I tend to that world, perhaps is guided by how I feel that I tend to my dead and my ancestors and how I am in conversation with them.
Very much, very much. I used to think of Mage as like, his classroom was a kind of zendo,
Yeah,
and
that's good.
office hours were like dokusan, like private instruction, and that he so carefully tended to his sangha, his flock of students, in a way that nobody else could. And with you and I feel we are sort of brethren with him as a shared fixture of teaching and wisdom. And in reflection, I'm just wondering, are there things that you want to offer? I'm hopeful that maybe you have poem to close us out with, or some reflections, some offerings? What do you feel?
Sure. Maybe I'll close with a piece called Kissing Lightning. Yeah, so this weaves in some voices from writers I love and Mage, and it's a piece I wrote and read at the 40th anniversary for the Wick Poetry Center.
Which we didn't even get to touch on, which was such a profound experience. Could you talk a, just briefly a little bit about the 40th, the
The
event?
Gathering. Yeah, so I mean, Charlie Malone, Jessica Jewell at the Wick Poetry Center, Georgie Mihai before she moved on to a new job. We worked for well, we organized for well over a year, dreaming up how this could be, and essentially we realized that we had this opportunity to bring back first book winners and chapbook authors. We call them the ever expanding Wick family of poets. Had profound experience, being published and coming to Kent, having their careers galvanized by this ability, this opportunity to have a beautiful book published by the Kent State Press. And we brought back over 40 authors from around the country. And then we had each day, we had first book and chapbook authors, groupings of them read, sometimes 15 to 16 read, 5 minutes each. And this was in addition to the panels and the workshops and the featured readings that we had. Maggie highlighting Maggie's reading, the kickoff on a Thursday night, and then Padraig O Tuama, Naomi Shihab Nye, Jane Hirschfield, and Adrian Matika were the four featured readers who gave a beautiful reading on Friday night. It was the most, we call it charging the air. I mean, the air was so charged for those 3 days with such a generosity of spirit and a love.
I mean, being there, it could not have, there couldn't been a greater expression of the spirit of what you'd want in poetry, that the traces of kind of like all the elements of poetry and poets that we want to shy away from, it didn't exist there in any way, shape, or form. There's a pure spirit of true honoring what poetry is about, in my understanding and estimation, yeah.
Yeah. So I, only, after spending so many months organizing it, only closer to the actual event did I realize, oh, well, I'm a Wick author. Like I'm not just behind the scenes. I need to stand up for 5 minutes and testify and share poems. And I think my initial thought was, I'll read older poems. And then I think something in me realized that I needed to share what was deepest and most currently tugging on my heart. And it was a relatively new piece that I had not really read out loud. And it is kind of a braided essay. I think, the other piece of it was a way for me to acknowledge too, as I introduced it, that I had learned how to keen from Maggie Anderson.
Yeah, how beautiful to bring it back to that. Yeah.
And then it weaves in Mage, who has guided me in my maturation, in my growth. And I acknowledge, I think, that by coincidence and, some sort of larger clicking of a jigsaw puzzle, the 40th anniversary, because it had to be a weekend, and we found the one weekend in September that it was the hotel was available. It opened on that Thursday night on the anniversary of my mother's death.
Oh my God,
And I think all along I have felt this porosity, this porosity between my role officially public, my public role leading the Wick Poetry Center, and my private role in searching to make whole, to heal past wounds and loss. And if, we call ourselves word nerds at the Wick Poetry Center, and I love etymologies and origins of the word. The word to heal from Old English means literally just to make whole, to integrate. And so we you know, poems can help us make whole. They can help us integrate past experiences in our lives that have broken us.
Yes.
So we are, you know, none of us escape being broken by life, but poems are a place where we make sense of that brokenness and in its own form, make it whole. You know, the work we've done in hospitals at WIC, we've worked with cancer patients who have been technically cured, which means to eradicate a virus or a cancer, but they feel completely unhealed. They
Yep.
feel unwhole. And so, you know, the narrative writing they do and the narrative medicine that they do to talk about what they've been through is an important final piece of that true healing. You know, they've been cured but not healed until they've given voice to that experience.
Yeah,
And I work with Talia.
the body is healed, but the soul is catching up.
The soul's catching up.
The soul is catching up.
And many times I've worked with seniors and with palliative care patients and caregivers who have no opportunity. We don't cure the inevitable path we go down toward our own transition. Their writing was a way of healing what could not be cured. So their bodies are not going to be cured of that disease that's going to kill them or of their age, but the writing is a healing that happens near the end of their life.
Sure.
So I've had the blessing of he of not waiting to the end of my life to be healed through the loving work of poetry and Mage and Maggie and my Sangha of poets and the tradition in Kent of gathering to hear each other read. So this is called Kissing Lightning. The Ikung people in the Kalahari hold all-night healing rituals when someone in their village is ill or has suffered a loss. The women gather around the fire and begin dancing and singing and clapping. Then the men join in, and slowly the energy builds until one or several becomes filled with what they call noum, the healing energy of the cosmos. They often collapse to the ground because of the intensity bordering on painful. Once one tunes into that energy, it can be shared and transferred to those who are ill or grieving. They say it is like kissing lightning. I've cried so many times reading my poems during open readings at Last Exit Books in Kent and felt my grief observed, touched into matter. Like the observer effect, my grief could not become real to me, something I could face until it was seen and heard by the loving attention of others. My friend Mage once said that he didn't come to Last Exit for the poems exactly. He could read those on the page by himself. He came to feel what could happen when we gathered together to read our poems to each other. Mayan shaman Martine Prechtel says that the enzyme of grief is always present, like yeasts that are in the air, ready to transmute what is toxic and hard to digest in grains into bread and beer, or change grape sugar into wine and vinegar. Or like the rennet in a calf's stomach, which converts what even a calf can't digest in his own mother's milk into delicious, life-giving cheese. Grief, as a spiritual enzyme, waits for our sorrow. We are changed by grief and have to allow it to instigate in us what it always has, the ultimate and only legitimate source of all human expression, of beauty, real art, and kindness. I discovered the enzyme of grief waiting in the air at Last Exit, waiting to change me, metabolize my loss and shame into a spiritual substance, become medicine for our community. I'm convinced that we should solve many things, writes Miguel Unamuno. If we all went out into the streets and uncovered our grief, which perhaps would prove to be but one soul common grief, and be joined together in beweeping them. My friend Sandy Hallam told me in Kent the other day that she saw my essay about my therapist, Bocata George, published online. She said she also went to Vokada George for years to work through issues with her own mother. She thought of Okada as a mother figure and loved her. "We mustn't forget those who saved us," Sandy said. Then she told me she carried an image of me from my mother's calling hours years ago that she has never been able to forget. She said she watched me standing by my mother's open casket, holding her hand and stroking it as people walked through Bissler's funeral home. She said, "I looked like I was not in my body at that time, but I wouldn't leave." My mother sighed. I have no memory of this. Only a vague sense as a 12-year-old boy of the terrible injustice I believed was done to my mother's body and how it all felt wrong. In healthy cultures, Frances Weller says, one person's wound is an opportunity for another to bring medicine. But if you are silent about your suffering, then your friends stay spiritually unemployed. Remember not to leave this world without ceremony, Mage instructed us in his poem, The Heartbeat of Ordinary Things. But my mother did. And I've spent years going back in time with my writing to create ceremony for my mother. Because healing ripples backwards and forwards. The writing has been my life's work. To write something worthy of her, to create ceremony. It was Mage who sat with me often at my mother's grave in Standing Rock Cemetery and taught me how to listen. I listened to my mother speaking to me through the open channel of Mage's heart. "How did you escape?" Mage asked me one day, and I knew he meant my grief. "I escaped by staying here," I told him, "in Kent. And if you are able to feed the other world with your grief, then you can live where your dead are buried. They will become a part of the landscape. I have been seasoned and made whole, sitting in circles with poets, one poem answering another, yoking solitude to community, drawing down healing energy from the charged air of poems. It takes more than one of us to speak. At times it feels like kissing lightning."